This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on Sunday, the 1st of February, on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly in association with Persol. Hello and welcome to edition 291 of the Monocle Weekly in association with Persol, here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up, we're joined by a pianist and entertainer whose latest tracks are inspired by the likes of Henry VIII, Daft Punk, and You Cannot Be Serious, John McEnroe. It can only be Chilly Gonzalez, who joins us in the studio to discuss his new album, Chambers.
Also ahead, thimbles at the ready. Harvard professor Sven Beckert unpicks the stitches in the historical relationship between capitalism and the 19th century's most important commodity, cotton.
And Art with a Difference, we hear about the I Am Gallery, founded in Damascus in 2006, and now showcasing Middle Eastern artists in spaces spanning Dubai to London.
All that, plus our look ahead to the stories sure to set the news agenda in the week ahead, all coming up here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Good afternoon, Andrew.
Good afternoon. Did you like my impersonation in there? That was good, wasn't it?
I got, I was ducking, fearing that a wooden racket was going to come flying in my direction. Or at least some balls.
How are you, Mr. Bounds?
Yeah, I'm very well. I wasn't here last week, went to the seaside.
I know you did.
A cold day for that, but a bracing
for Lady Bird Books.
I went for Lady Bird Books, which was amazing. I'm sure lots of our listeners will have a deep emotional response to just the name Lady Bird Books and those iconic, amazing little hardback books that told, especially British and I suppose Commonwealth people, how the world worked, what people did for a living, and told them fairy tales and all those. It had a golden age, I suppose, from the 50s to the 70s. And I certainly grew up with those books, and it was an amazing nostalgic rush to go to the wonderful De La Warr Pavilion. I'm in Bexhill-on-Sea, where there's an exhibition called the Lady Bird by Design, and it's absolutely amazing. You'd love it. I loved it.
I think
lots of our listeners, especially design-conscious people, a lot of design nuts. Our creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell, was very jealous that I got on a train early on Friday morning and went down to spend the weekend at the seaside to look at all those wonderful Lady Bird books. It's amazing.
Okay.
Yeah.
We accept that you weren't here last week. That's fine then, Robert. You've really been called into the headmaster's office to explain. Where were you last week?
I gave a real hard sell, didn't
that's
I?
Good. No,
that was good. It's a great show.
And what's interesting is we're not going to be talking about those in this show.
I know, well, that was last week. What's going to happen this week? What were you doing then? Let's have your.
I went to see the London Art Fair.
Oh yeah,
last weekend.
I had a bit of London Art Fair. I thought it was good this year.
Yeah, I did as well.
Yeah,
I can't help but go ringing around though as like a potential shopper. I never really kind of looking at art for art's sake. I'm always thinking, would that look nice on my wall, even if I can't afford it. I get a bit kind of shopaholic when I'm.
Well, you know what it's like to be properly rich and go to Art Basel.
Yeah, and what was funny is this is not the kind of the top tier of kind of shows anyway. It's not the Frieze.
Yeah,
but the number of Russian accents in there, which makes you realise that how. You know, how big a middle-class community of Russians there are now in London as well. You know, it wasn't kind of people with bodyguards. It was, you know, mothers and fathers with their kids and their prams, but wealthy Russians going around. And, yeah, intriguing how even that part of the art market has kind of changed, really.
It wasn't people with bodyguards, but you should have seen the bodies.
Anyway, I had a very nice time.
But okay. That's good.
Didn't put any red stickers on anything.
Did you not?
No.
Okay. I almost did.
Did you?
A friend of mine was exhibiting there. I thought, well,
thank God I wasn't with you, because I once was at an art exhibition with you, and we had a couple of drinks, and then you persuaded me it was a very good idea to buy a picture, which I still have on my wall to this day. Okay, we should move along. We should get in.
It's news time, isn't it? With the one and only Tom Edwards.
From Monocle's editorial floor comes the world's hardest hitting journalist.
Like a cuddly newsman. That's the effect I'm looking for.
He has uncompromising standards.
That's right, I'm setting the bar that low.
And is never afraid to expose new ideas. It's Tom Edwards with the news look ahead.
Sometimes you've got to stick with what you know.
Well, you don't know much. Well, we did promise you would get rid of that one, because I'm feeling a bit...
Notice that's stayed in there.
I know, but somehow...
Weekly
somehow,
derision.
When people have a choice, they always pick that one.
I know, something about it appeals to people's... sensibilities. I don't know why. What that is exactly.
And what's your big news of the week?
The look ahead. You want me to come
straight into it?
No. We were saying things we've done. You got a new cardigan.
I like your new cardigan.
You only wore it the once, though.
Once a week is reasonable. Oh, yeah.
If I have something new, I wear it all the time. This one I'm wearing today, I've worn it a lot.
I'll break it out again tomorrow.
If you wouldn't
mind. We'll look forward to it.
It's a deal. Make note of that, listeners.
And in other news...
Shall we do the news?
Yeah, let's talk about a few things that happened this week. I've got one thing for each day. Tomorrow's Groundhog Day, which is this lunatic event in America. And I only really mention that because it's a... You know, can look back on the demise of the great Harold Ramis from...
Yeah.
I think that was in 2014, but I mean, it was within the last... It was, I think, since the last Groundhog Day. And he obviously made the film that popularised this stupid woodchuck who predicts the weather for the springtime, whatever, it's in Pennsylvania.
You've had a bad day.
Stupid woodchuck.
Well, it's a ridiculous thing, isn't it? Let's be honest. It's a ripping good yarn. And I will do a doff of the cap to Harold Ramis. So that's tomorrow.
Is there anything, I wonder if anything surrounds Groundhog Day? It's clearly not quite an event worth a national holiday in the United States.
It's probably getting there.
But, I wonder if it must be an excuse for a feast.
I think there
something
probably
like
is.
That.
What you mean in Punxsutawney?
Yeah.
I think it all goes off there.
In Punxsutawney, yeah.
These days. The world's media probably descends.
Yeah.
Fried groundhog, roasted groundhog.
I don't know what it's like to eat. It's probably like... is it probably like guinea pig? I don't know. You can eat that in
a bit bigger,
Peru.
Right?
You
Peru,
eat quite a lot of that, don't you? Which is quite tasty. But
which means it's quite tasty. You've had one.
Well, you got to try these things. You can't knock them until you've tried them. Groundhog's next. Watch out, woodchucks. Tuesday, I got a couple of interesting seasonal festivals out of Japan this week. On Tuesday, it's the Setsubun Festival, seasonal division. Part of the sort of spring festivals.
Like seasonal division.
That's what it's called. That's what it means in
it
Japanese.
It sounds like you're having a live translation in one ear and you're saying it.
I'm just hearing that...
apparently means seasonal division.
It's a cleansing ritual. So you drive away evil spirits for the years to come by scattering beans, roasted beans, around your home, in temples and shrines, all over.
Mm-hmm.
And
baked beans do?
I think so. Well, I don't know. They're baked. They must be roasted, Andrew. Come on.
What about Space Invaders?
Rob, you're just being silly.
Sorry.
And you shout, "Devil's out, happiness in." And then when it's finished, you need to seek out and eat one bean for each year since your birth. That's quite a lot of beans, isn't it?
Oh, and then stay away from me in the afternoon.
I was going to say, the next day they'll know where you've been.
What's the other seasonal one that's happening in Japan tomorrow?
That's on Thursday. It starts on Thursday in Sapporo, the Snow Festival. You might have heard of this one.
Seen this,
It's a very, very big deal. 2 million people descend on Sapporo for that. It's been going since 1950. Some local students built these sort of snow statues in Odori Park. And then the Japanese Self-Defense Force got involved and they built a huge monumental sculpture. Now it's huge, like snow and ice sculptures. People come from far and wide.
I wonder what statue did the Japanese Self-Defense Force decide to make?
All I know is that it was massive and made of snow.
A big shield.
It probably had, some kind of militaristic, totemistic quality. I don't know.
Okay, before we get in trouble.
I think that's reasonable. Wednesday. Now, I like novelty endurance events. We talk about these quite often. Run across the US, all this kind of thing.
Mm.
There's the Esbrew in Manhattan, in New York, on Wednesday. Can you guess what that is? It's an endurance, very particular endurance event.
Easy Brew, is it? Or Esbrew?
Esbrew, it's an acronym.
Is it a drinking competition? A beer drinking competition?
It's proper physical endeavour.
Running?
It is running. But it's different kind of running. Not just a round.
Up.
Five boroughs.
Uphill.
Up. Empire State.
Up in State. Oh,
yes!
Empire State Building run-up. Just listen to the stats. This has been going since the late 70s. 1,575 stairs of the Empire State Building. Mm. It's 1,050 vertical metres. And you think, 1,000 metres, that's not much, but that's directly upwards. So it's pretty impressive. 1,500 stairs. What do you think the record is? So it's literally just running up the stairs from ground level
steps
all the way to the top of the building. But it's like a kilometre, I think. Is that?
I reckon it's
10 minutes.
Almost exactly bang on, actually. 9:33, the record for gentlemen. 11:23.
Oh, you did it in 10 minutes, Andrew. It's not bad.
11:23. The lift doesn't count, Andrew. But isn't that extraordinary?
And it's taking Monday off.
So. That's a long way, isn't it?
Imagine the lag. Because I sometimes run up the escalator at Warren Street and I have to have a break at the top because I've got lactic build-up. Imagine that. I think that's incredible. I think these people are insane.
You've got lactic build-up?
Yeah. In the muscles.
All right. You need to change your bra.
Dear me. Need to get some more devil beans from Septagon Festival. Let's race through the rest of this because we're careening towards the edge of the valley. Friday, this is serious. The Munich Security Conference in Germany. Senior figures from around the world engage on, you know, intensive debates, current and future security challenges. We'll be covering that on Monocle 24. That's a genuine serious, interesting thing. There's no doubt.
Only with weapons made of ice?
No, everything, anything goes.
Okay.
And then snowballs, legitimate.
And then finally?
And then finally, because I like endurance events, also, if they involve animals, all the better. Mm. The Yukon Quest takes place next Saturday. Just listen to this. Sled dog racing. I've never done it. I want to. How far? Just 1,000 miles. 1,000 actual measured miles from Whitehorse, Yukon to Fairbanks, Alaska. And they wait until the actual very worst possible time of year for the weather. This week in February. It's ridiculous.
And it's 1,000 miles.
I presume the dogs have to change teams. You can't have this one.
No, you keep going. It takes a while. So it starts.
Yeah, I know, but you mean you change teams of dogs, don't you?
Oh, no, they have to have a break and then they get cracking again in the morning. It starts on schedule, regardless of the weather, and lasts from 10 to 16 days. So there's a whole week of potential variety in how long it can take just because of the conditions. They don't stop until the final dog team arrives at the finish line. Imagine that,
yeah. I think we should send a team out next year.
I'd give it a bash.
Andrew could go with Maisie.
That's quite
a bit. Maisie fair in that. Yeah. She's full of energy.
Yeah, she is full of energy. Imagine giving the squeaky
toy.
Pig.
Just on dangle on a, that.
Yeah.
I don't think she'd go pulling
thousand
very
miles.
Far.
Extraordinary.
And didn't like that. He's got all human. Serious. He started adjusting
his
papers.
I'm trying to work out how a dog can do that. That's pretty amazing.
That is the
feat. How many teams? Do they have like sort of eight dogs in a team?
I think it could be eight. Yeah.
Yeah,
and the dynamics between the dogs are important, you know, because obviously they're sort of.
You need to have the leader at the front and da 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 da. There's a
lot
politics,
of,
isn't there, to do
mushing.
With it.
Rum rum. He's the leader of the pack.
Beautiful. Human and canine endurance this week.
Love it, Tom. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres. Nova York, Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
Well, to call our next guest a Renaissance man would be to undersell his many talents. Pianist, producer, rapper and consummate entertainer just about starts to cover it. Taking inspiration from classical and contemporary music alike, Chilly Gonzalez is unique in his field.
The last time Chilly and I met was in North London, where he was just about to perform pieces from his last album, Solo Piano 2, to a packed-out venue, and I had the privilege of an on-stage piano lesson with the maestro himself that was not without some fraught danger and fraught moments, I think, Chilly.
I'm a demanding teacher.
Well, I think you were firm but fair, but as I said, before we switched the microphones on, I said, oh yeah, do you remember you gave me that piano lesson at the Roundhouse and you looked slightly blank, but, you know, politely blank. And I said, do you remember I was the crap one? And then you remembered who I was.
Yes, it all came rushing back. But the thing is, as a teacher, I don't just demand the sort of musical attention and engagement, but if I'm doing it on a stage, I need a good partner on stage, whether it's a fall guy, whether it's whether it's the cute girl, you know, whether it's the charming 13-year-old boy. There's different things that will always play differently to an audience. So I think I'm a doubly demanding teacher. So I think you made it through relatively unscathed. I mean, we're sitting here being friendly across a table.
It's a warm atmosphere. It's okay.
Yes.
Well, I think I know which of the three of those examples I am. I'm definitely not the cute girl or the 13-year-old boy. So I guess I'm the fall guy.
Well, I don't know, maybe emotionally you're like a 13-year-old boy. I'm not sure. You know, we don't know each other well enough yet.
We're getting into strange psychological territory, which I feel is often the case when I listen to your records, Chilly. We're here today to talk about the upcoming record, Chambers, which, as all of your records, seems to have some great stories behind the songs. Maybe you can tell Andrew and I, first of all, what the sort of kickoff for it was after, because the last thing was all about sort of reintroducing people to the piano, and it was a bit of a didactic didactic thing. This is an out-and-out record, isn't it?
Sure. This is the real true follow-up to Solo Piano 2, I suppose.
Yeah.
And in the intervening years since that record came out in 2012, I basically got addicted to learning how to write for other instruments, and specifically the string quartet. Now, I met a string quartet in Hamburg called the Kaiser Quartet, and I started to have a kind of a back and forth with them, and I would send them little ideas and see how they played when they recorded them on iPhones and just sent me the MP3 back. And slowly we built up a body of work together. I started to travel to Hamburg and workshop the songs, and 2.5 years later, this is the record that resulted from that.
And I understand from the another thing I was reading that some of the inspiration is the likes of even people like John McEnroe. How do they fit into this story?
Well, when I'm composing instrumental music, I like to have some image or iconic person or something in mind. I'm not terribly inspired by feelings or people asking me, do you picture some journey in a river? And, you know, people have their sort of poetic interpretations. I leave space in the music so that people can make their own interpretation. But there's a long history of dedicating pieces in classical music. Usually you would dedicate a piece to your patron. So you would kind of have to kiss the Archduke's ass by saying, hey, this bagatelle is for you, you know, Archduke Ronaldo or whoever. Or it was maybe the beautiful piano student, the daughter of the prince, that you were forbidden to consummate your love with. And so you have a dedication to Sweet Esmeralda, let's say. Anyway, I kind of decided to run with that and share some of the inspirations so that people can maybe listen through a little bit of a prism. A piece like Advantage Points, which not only has a sort of tennis-themed name, was inspired by the idea of the energy and intensity of how it feels to be an athlete in the sort of the heat of battle. At the same time, there's something very poetic watching a guy like John McEnroe play, and there's a feeling of he's also soaring above the action in a way. So I kind of tried to present these two contrasting sections, one of which is bum, 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 and has that kind of athletic intensity, and then the moment of transcendence, where you can imagine, for example, Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe's famous match in 1980 at Wimbledon, and you can almost imagine if there was a film about it that they would literally levitate. And that's the kind of music I was trying to write, you know, once they transcend the actual pressure of the athletic moment. And then you're essentially an artist, you know, a great athlete when he hits his zone is an artist.
I really can't wait to hear the bit of the album which is swearing at the line judge. Presumably that's just lots of staccato stabs. I don't know what that might be. In a seamless
segue. You can't be serious, man!
Precisely. How on earth do you sort that out with a string quartet from Hamburg? We'll find out on the album.
Well, they're German, so it's like, you cannot be serious, man.
What part of Glasgow are you from?
that was a bit of kind of a mix up there.
I'm very bad at accents. I told you, it's an instrumental record. It's instrumental for a
reason.
Yeah,
it is. Okay. In a seamless segue, as we're talking about John McEnroe, we're going to play a track now dedicated to the Ukrainian composer Reinhold Glierer, and then we're going to talk about that. So this is called Odessa. That is a bit of a track from Chilly Gonzalez's new album called Chambers. That track's called Odessa. Talk us through that one. That's a mellifluous thing.
Yeah, that's one of the more, I would say, truly classically inspired. It has a time signature that you don't hear much outside of classical music, which is 6-4. It's a very slow kind of processional version of triple time. Maybe like a waltz in slow motion would make sense. But it has a kind of stately Eastern Russian vibe. Part of that comes from the use of some more jagged kind of folky harmonies that come from Eastern music. And as a coming from a Jewish Hungarian background, you know, I generally gravitate to that kind of sound when I'm going for the sad, bittersweet nostalgia that you hear in sort of all Eastern music, whether it's Jewish or Balkan. And this composer, Reinhold Glierer, he's just interesting because no one really knows him. He's really not very well known, but he's this crazy bridge between much more famous Russian composers, being Tchaikovsky as the sort of catchy hit-making machine.
It's super romantic.
Yeah, and he wrote hits. I mean, he was just making banger after banger unapologetically. And then you have a guy like Prokofiev, who is like a modernist, or Stravinsky. And Glière kind of occupies this space. And I always like to find underdog composers that people don't know, champion them a little bit. And he was really directly responsible for me trying to find that sweet spot between something catchy and accessible in the Tchaikovsky way, which I always find inspiring because I like hit-making composers, first and foremost, but also that deeper, sort of deep cut thing you get in the sadder music of Prokofiev and Stravinsky.
Actually, anyone who listens to you, even for, I think, a couple of minutes, will realize you have numerous passions. And as we reference, you know, you've been working with Daft Punk, you've worked with Feist, you've done classical music, you've tried to teach people to return to taking piano lessons. When you kind of settle down on a project, is it quite difficult to decide, you know, what you want to do in a day? Because it sounds like you have so many ideas and so many inspirations and so many people wanting to collaborate with you. Is it hard to kind of literally kind of think what your year is going to be?
No, I mean, generally my own projects, I wait until it really feels right, and then I spend quite a bit of time on them. The, you know, the Reintroduction Etudes, the book for lapsed pianists, was a few years in the making. The Chambers album was, again, the product of 2.5 years of learning how to write for strings and being engaged in that. You know, the collaborations, it looks like everyone is knocking down my door wanting to work with me, but it actually is much more, thankfully, natural than that. I don't try to do collaborations because I don't particularly like them. But of course, I meet lots of other musicians, and sometimes a musician needs a very specific job done. So when Daft Punk asks to collaborate with me, I just want to clarify, they're not just like, we think Chilly Gonzalez is just a great dude and we want him to be around us for our next album. It's more like, hey, can you come? We're having a problem making a transition between two songs. One of them is in B flat minor, one of them is in A minor. We want something, maybe a piano interlude, that brings us from one to the other. So it's a very specific job, and that's what I love, because I wouldn't feel confident trying to tell Daft Punk what they should do in a more general sense. They're obviously geniuses at running a career and being ahead of the curve. And if anything, I have more to learn from them than vice versa. But in this one particular instance, they honed in on my exact wheelhouse, which is harmony and an understanding of the world in which Daft Punk lives. I'm a man of my time. I've decided to devote myself to being someone who can exist in the world of pop music, despite having my own tastes in classical colors and jazz interpretation, all that. I don't want to live in those worlds. I'm a man of my time. I want to be a pop musician without sacrificing what I really love. Is that so wrong? I mean, really, you know?
He's taking his shirt off and waving it around his head. He's gone bananas. We're going to queue up another track. While we muse on that last question that you posed to us, Chilly. This is called Green's Leaves. People will not be surprised, perhaps, to hear that this riffs on the idea of Henry VIII. That was a decidedly pastoral field, isn't it? Green's Leaves. That's from Chilly Gonzalez's new record, Chambers. So what's the story behind that? I mean, Henry VIII was supposed to have written Green's Leaves.
Yeah, I mean, it's much disputed. It's you know, copyright law wasn't what it was today. What it is today.
Yeah.
Green's Leaves is just, it's also just a nice, I just kind of realized at one point when I was late at night looking at some green leaves that were in a bag on my desk, if you know what I'm saying. And it occurred to me,
I always write on green paper as well.
And it occurred to me that the word green sleeves could be divided into this pun, and I thought it was a brilliant idea. Those are the kinds of ideas that, when those green sleeves are on your desk, those seem like great ideas, you know. It's a very specific kind of idea, and there was this song that to me had a certain sort of celebratory town square kind of feel to it. And so I was looking for something that was going to be pastoral. And Green's Leaves just checked all the boxes. And on top of it all, it had that great little inside joke with myself, which I've now shared with the world.
And you're on the road quite a lot. Is it, I looked at your website, quite a few numbers of dates for touring coming up. Where are you heading?
Basically, all the big metropoli that have that mixture of slightly older fans who maybe listen to a lot of classical and jazz, but appreciate some of the new irreverent energy I bring to it, or whether it's the aging hipsters who I've grown old with, and who are ready to indulge in my slightly more musically deep side. But basically, everywhere, we'll make it to.
We should encourage people to go and look at your website because they can find out all about the tickets. And
sure, and I'm touring with the Kaiser Quartet, and the show is going to include all of the material from Chambers, of course. But then the fun part is recasting some of my rap material, recasting some of my electronic material, and applying a song that I might have done with the DJ Boys Noise or some music that I made with Drake, and turning it into something that works as chamber music. You know, the idea of this album was that, in a way, chamber music was the moment when music started to belong to everybody. It really kind of came from the royal court and or the church and sort of became something that people could do in their rooms, the burgeoning middle class, all buying a piano and going, hey, we want to have someone come play this piano. We want to have a violin player come and hear a sonata. And this is in a way, we're in a similar moment now musically, I feel, that music has become for everyone. Everyone can grab Ableton. And the chamber has now gone from a living room to the space in between your headphones, but it's still the same concept. The music getting more and more democratic, more shareable, which is the point of music. And that's why I wanted to see if I could bring chamber music into the present, use those techniques, use those colors, but make today's pop music with those instruments.
And likely or not, the album is called Chambers, and it's done in the Led Zeppelin font.
Is that a Led Zeppelin font?
Yeah, that, isn't it? I think it is. Anyway, that's a terrible way to end a discussion. And therefore, it's quite amusing. Chilly Gonzalez,
what
thank
a buzzkill
as ever for your time today. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. We're going to play some music now. This is new from Chilly Gonzalez, as promised. This is Advantage Points, dedicated, as Andrew was talking about before, to John McEnroe. Thank you.
And that was Chilly Gonzalez with his new track, Advantage Points, dedicated to the one and only John McEnroe. Boop.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story. Sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was almost worth $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
Think cotton, and perhaps you think of that nice weekend shirt hanging in your wardrobe or a fresh, crisp bedding. But after you read a new book by Harvard professor Sven Beckert, chances are it'll take more than a dose of fabric softener to see this seemingly benign material in the same way again.
That new book is Empire of Cotton, A New History of Global Capitalism. And it takes a look at cotton's leading role in stitching together not only the contents of our wardrobes, but the world as we know it and the history of capitalism itself. Sven Beckert joins us now from Harvard University. Thank you for coming on the show, Sven. Why did you feel that cotton, out of all the things we could think about, coal, wool, was the key commodity that best told the story of capitalism?
The reason why I decided to focus on a commodity to tell the story of capitalism is that I didn't want to tell the story of capitalism in the abstract, but I wanted to tell the history of capitalism in action. I wanted to tell the actual history of the historically how capitalism has unfolded. And in order to do so, no commodity is better suited than focusing on the commodity of cotton. Cotton was already before the Industrial Revolution the most important manufacturing industry in the world, and it was particularly concentrated in South Asia and Central America and in East Africa. So it was already a very important human activity before the advent of capitalism, and especially before the advent of the Industrial Revolution. And then, as you know, especially in the United Kingdom, cotton was at the center of the Industrial Revolution as it unfolded in the late 18th and 19th century. And that Industrial Revolution is at the very core, at the very origin of the world in which we live in today. And at that core of that Industrial Revolution, again, was the commodity of cotton. And then if you look at the history of the advent of manufacturing all over the world, it is, again, the cotton industry that is at its very center. If you look at continental Europe, if you look at the United States, if you look at India, China, Japan, Egypt, Brazil, and other countries, it is always in cotton that these parts of the world had industrialized first. And then I think what also a focus on the commodity of cotton, what it allows you to do is to combine changes within cities and industry with changes in agriculture and the global countryside. And so one thing you see right away when you look at the history of capitalism through the history of cotton is, for example, the tight connection between the expansion of industry and wage labor in some parts of the world, like the United Kingdom, and at the same time, the expansion and intensification of slave labor in the global countryside, in the Caribbean and Brazil, and especially in the southern United States.
A particular review of your book, Sven, makes a very good point. With every era, and especially every era of industrialization, there's a commodity to go with it, and the profits and losses and human losses perhaps are tied up with it. Which era, which century, if you like, does this pertain to cotton?
I think it does pertain especially to the late 18th and then throughout the 19th century. As I said, cotton was at the core of the Industrial Revolution. The United Kingdom as it exists today is a result of the importance of the cotton industry to the United Kingdom and the particular position of the United Kingdom in the world. But if you look at the 20th century, cotton is still a very important industry even to this day. If you look at the 21st century, so today approximately 124 million bales of cotton are produced in the world, which if you would stack them on top of one another would be a tower 40,000 miles high. And this makes enough cotton to produce 20 t-shirts for every living person on the globe. So even today, it has been estimated that today up to 350 million people in the world are still in some ways engaged in the growing of cotton or the manufacturing of cotton or the stitching of cotton clothing. So this is a very substantial share of humanity. And thus, you know, while I don't think that cotton is at the center of the global economy today and not of the global economy of the second half of the 20th century, it is still very, very important.
I mean, you mentioned T-shirts there. We read a slightly glib introduction to cotton, Sven, when we introduced you.
Nice.
I think when you mention the word cotton, I think there are quite a lot of negative connotations to it, despite the fact it obviously has pulled countries, entire countries and economies out of the dark ages into the Industrial Revolution and beyond. There are obviously as many sweatshops today as there were in the bad old days. Or maybe there aren't. Maybe you can tell me that. But it is a product, presumably, that has an automatic dark side in people's imaginations. Did you find that when you were researching the book?
Right. So I think it's important to see that there are two sides to the story and that we need to think about both of these stories at the same time. The first story is a story of a huge increase in human creativity and human productivity. Today, we are able to grow much, much more cotton than ever before in world history, and we're able to produce much more clothing. And that is certainly something that has helped raise living standards in many different parts of the world. You presumably would not enjoy very much, for example, wearing woolen underwear today and only be able to wash it.
Each to their own, Sven. Come on, this is still England.
So this is clearly also a story of huge progress in some ways. But this went along with an enormous degree of exploitation and an enormous degree of violence. The violence is to be found in the 19th century on slave plantations. It is to be found in places like Lancashire, where children were forced to work in cotton factories. It is found in the 20th century and today in places such as India, Uzbekistan, Brazil, and then in places like Vietnam, Bangladesh, and China, where people often today work under unbelievably terrible conditions at very, very low wages to produce clothing to be sold in Europe and North America and elsewhere at sometimes unbelievably cheap prices. So I think it's both of that. And in order to understand, since the book is really two things, it's to tell the story of cotton, but it's also really to come to terms with what is so important in our contemporary lives, namely capitalism and the history of that capitalism. I think we need to recognize that this history has both of these elements to it.
And just tell me on a very clear point for you, you're sitting in the US, would the slave trade have existed and prospered if it hadn't been for cotton?
The slave trade comes before cotton, and slavery comes to cotton actually relatively late, only in the second half of the 18th century, and only as a result of the intensification of cotton production in Europe and especially in the United Kingdom. So slavery, plantation slavery, emerged at first independent of cotton. But once there was a huge new demand for raw cotton coming out of European factories, and again, coming mostly out of English factories, there was a huge new demand for raw cotton, and that raw cotton was then produced largely by slave labor, and it was largely produced by the late 18th century, and then in the first half of the 19th century, it was largely produced in the United States. And in the United States, it was until the American Civil War more or less exclusively produced by slave labor. And so the vibrancy of slavery in the United States, the expansion of slavery into the territories of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, further west, is a direct result of the expansion of cotton manufacturing in the United Kingdom. And therefore, if you walk the streets today of places like Manchester or Liverpool or Oldham, these are places that obviously themselves did not see slavery, and slavery seems to be far removed from these places, but in some way they are very directly linked to the enormous violence that descended upon African Americans in the first half of the 19th century.
Sven, your book very much takes the long view on the history of cotton and its root as the formation of global capitalism. Which industry today do you think apes the early structure of how cotton was traded in maybe the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries in Europe and then in the Americas? I wonder if you can transpose the contemporary onto that history.
I think what you learn from the history of cotton for looking at the contemporary moment is, for one, that you cannot understand any part of our economy of global capitalism today without taking a global perspective. You cannot understand the United Kingdom just, let's say, on its own terms, but you need to embed it within a larger global story. And obviously these global links, not so much with cotton, but with other commodities such as, for example, oil, or in particular oil, still link industrialized parts of of the world, to not so industrialized parts of the world. And so I think that what you learn from that is, I don't think one particular commodity, except perhaps oil, is as much as the center of the global economy that cotton was in the early 19th century. But what you learn from looking at cotton is to emphasize the importance of these global connections, to not write history or to not think about the contemporary moment only in terms of national, local, or regional stories, but to think of them as necessarily also global stories that you cannot understand on their own terms. And then beyond that, I think what you also understand, and the history of oil certainly illustrates this extremely well, is that the history of capitalism cannot be understood as a history somehow opposed to the history of states. Markets are not opposed to states. States have constructed markets, and they do so to our moment today. And therefore, a particular way of looking at the long history of capitalism, I think, is also very well suited to understanding the contemporary moment. And the way I look at the long history of capitalism puts a certain emphasis on certain factors that, let's say, many contemporary economists, for example, are not known to emphasize.
Okay, Sven, well, thank you very much for talking to us. That was Sven Beckert, author of Empire of Cotton, A New History of Global Capitalism. And that is out now, published by Penguin.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
As Design Miami celebrated its 10th anniversary this year, Monocle Films explored new themes in the collectible design market.
I think that we're beginning to become more of a design-driven culture as we learn to consume more responsibly. We're beginning to learn that better design helps us actually live better. And I think America's finally waking up to that fact.
Pull up a chair to watch Design Miami 2014, now playing in the films menu at monocle.com.
Syria today has become sadly synonymous with conflict, but back in 2006, long before the country's current crisis began, the IAM Gallery was founded in Damascus. Now recognised as a leading cultural voice in the region, the gallery represents a host of Middle Eastern artists with spaces in Beirut, Dubai and London.
But how do you promote art from a region often known these days more for destruction than creation? And when it comes to the global art world, what are the hopes and expectations of audiences and artists alike? Hisham Samawi, the co-founder and managing partner of IAM Gallery, joins us now from Dubai. Thank you so much for coming on the line, Hisham. I wanted to ask you, first of all, just to explain a little bit about your story. So the gallery started off in Syria, and now you have all of these offshoots. Was that a product of the war in Syria, or would you have spread out anyway?
No, actually, you know, we started the gallery in 2006. And, you know, at that time, Syria was a very stable place. It had been stable for decades, one of the most stable countries in the region. And there was a really great art school there called the Faculty of Fine Arts, but there was no really contemporary art market there. There were no collectors buying art. And, you know, we opened the gallery there in 2006 and kind of launched it by doing a competition to try to discover young artists, because we had a sense that they were there, but they just weren't being connected to the market and developed. So when we started the gallery there, we were shocked by how much the wealth of talent that was in Syria. And we started the gallery there, and our first couple years were really successful there. And then we decided to branch out. I mean, my cousin and partner was in Damascus. I was in Dubai. And, you know, at that time, Dubai was quickly establishing itself as the center of the art market in the Middle East.
So, and Hisham, is your family, are you Emiratis or you're of Syrian extraction?
We're Syrian by origin. So, but we had both left Syria. Our families had left, you know, and gone on to the West. And then my cousin had moved back there in the early 2000s. And then I had moved to Dubai.
And is it a good place? I mean, obviously, there's a rich history of art. I mean, that people forget when there's a war on, that everything kind of seems to stand still. But I wonder if that's, I mean, it sounds like a terrible thing to say. I wonder if that's done you some sort of favor in the sense that it makes people more curious about the art that might be from the region and some of the art that might reflect the politics or the exasperation with the politics in your country, Hisham.
Definitely, was a big microscope on Syria and what was happening politically. I think that's why when people saw the art that we were promoting and had actually managed to get out of Syria and kind of take to the rest of the world, I think people were kind of blown away. I mean, I think, you know, they're always presented with all this carnage and all these horrible things. And then when they see the other side of it, which is, you know, really well-educated, amazingly creative artists who are, you know, of complete international, you know, standards and the ability to speak and relate to people all over the world, I think, you know, it really took it to the next level.
And Hisham, I know that you're concerned with, you know, presenting a quite complex image of the region. You don't want it all to be about guns and bombs, although many of the artists do cover those topics in their own way. You're an optimist at heart.
No, for sure. I mean, you know, not all the artists, you would think that they would use, you know, the politics and the war and all that stuff in their art just as a gimmick and all that. But the majority of the artists are amazing international artists who, you know, were producing and had gone kind of international way before the war. And, you know, they were based in Syria. Part of what we did as a gallery is as soon as the war started, we realized that, you know, the risk was way too high to not put a plan in motion, which was to actually get all the artists that we represented physically out of Syria and into safer places so that they could continue doing their art, which was adding so much value to the art scene.
I wanted to ask you about your collectors as well, the people that buy stuff. I mean, obviously, Art Dubai, I suppose, must have, as you were alluding to, is obviously a big marketplace, and it's kind of cemented Dubai as the art city in the Middle East. But in London and Beirut, are these international people stopping off to visit your gallery, or is it quite a local scene?
I mean, it's always been a very international scene. I remember even before when we first opened our gallery in Syria in 2006, I would say like 95% of the people buying art from us were not people in Syria. They were people who were traveling in the region and people who were coming to actually see the old town in Damascus and that were blown away by how edgy the contemporary art, you know, was that was actually in Damascus. And then it's like, you know, there's been an extension of it. I mean, anytime you have an emerging scene, it's always going to be first supported by, you know, regional and local collectors. But as the scenes kind of matured very quickly, I must say, you know, we've gotten on the radar of international collectors and people from all over the world. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, Art Dubai and Abu Dhabi Art and the art fairs and people coming and are being curious. But people are always looking for that next, you know, the next big thing. And I think Middle Eastern art has kind of gotten that label. And a lot of people are quite curious and don't want to miss the boat. So we're seeing definitely increased attention, you know, from international collectors, museums, institutions, who see the quality of and the value of the art that, you know, that we're representing.
And while your art is certainly traveling well, it seems that some of the artists have a bit of a more tricky time with it. There's been a recent problem here in London for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's been something we've dealt with from day one, and it's really a shame because these artists, you know, they work so hard and are so excited about getting opportunities in, you know, in foreign countries to do their shows. You know, we've had trouble getting artists, you know, from when they were in Syria to get them to Dubai, you know, then when we get them to Dubai, getting them to London or to the Netherlands. So, yeah, it's tough because, you know, a lot of times they get labeled by the country they're from and, you know, the foreign countries don't want them for some reason and they don't realize that these are just artists coming to, you know, for an exhibition. But, you know, the good news is, you know, once word gets out, it's kind of a little bit of a PR disaster for the bodies that, you know, that reject them. And then they, half the time, once the word gets out on social media or, you know, through channels or petitions and the truth of the matter comes out of what they're trying to do, you know, these things get reversed a lot of times.
The other side of that, Hisham, is the artist being let in the country, but the art not. That's something I've seen when I've been in Dubai and in Sharjah, actually, for biennales and art fairs. Does that happen less often? I mean, I suppose, especially in being in Beirut and being in London, but is it still a bit of a problem in Dubai in terms of the expression of an artist and the censorship of the state?
You know, that's not something we really find or have ever had an issue with. I mean, you know, we're not trying to do things that is going to offend people. An artist is going to do what they want to do. And, you know, it's not about self-censorship or censorship, but, you know, as a gallery and with our artists, we've never felt that there's anything that they've wanted to do that they've not been able to do. You know, I mean, in a country like Dubai, which might have some, you know, issues with nudity, I mean, our artists are not looking to, you know, do works in the nude. They have a different message they're trying to convey. So it's not about shocking or doing something just for the sake of upsetting people. You know, they know what they want to say and how they want to say it. And we've never faced really any censorship of anything that we've or the artists have wanted to do, you know, in Dubai or anywhere.
And where do you want to go next? I mean, it's a globe-trotting gallery. Do you have plans to go to the U.S. or do you want to break into Asia? What's the next sort of big market for you guys?
I mean, really, you know, our mandate, you know, and the kind of promise that we make to our artists is that we're gonna, you know, represent them and give them the best opportunities that they can and give them a kind of international platform. You know, London has definitely been a huge part of that. You know, it's really been great to break out of the region and out of the Middle East and to let our artists and, you know, be shown amongst all the great artists of the world and to let collectors and people see that, you know, it is on the same level and it's not just a regional art scene, but it's grown mature. You know, we've done fairs in New York and Los Angeles, and it's really exciting to cross, you know, cross the Atlantic and to actually go there and show this work there as well. So, you know, we're going to go out and push our artists, you know, all over the world, wherever opportunities come, because they deserve it. I mean, they have a great voice, they have a great message, and it's also great for people to see that there is, you know, something really positive coming out of the Middle East. It's not all this, you know, terrible death and destruction that you see, you know, and in many ways, you know, contemporary art is one of the only, you know, positive things that's really has an opportunity to go around the world for people to see that. So, you know, we see ourselves as ambassadors in many ways as well to kind of educate and show people that there is another side of humanity over here.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much, Hisham. That was Hisham Samawi, co-founder of I Am Gallery, and he was speaking to us from Dubai. And that is all for edition 291 of the Monocle Weekly. That was I liked everything. I liked Chile.
He is cool,
he's
Mr.
spicy.
Gonzalez.
He's an amusing character. He's a great raconteur.
I think he's got so many things going on in his head. He's like full of information and facts and ideas, and I find it quite hard to sit down.
And I always quite like his insistence that people like Mozart and Tchaikovsky were pop stars, and they wrote like not, you know, solid gold, drop down, drop dead. Stone dead.
Yeah, and you want to hear him talking about anything.
It's like, yeah. I'd
thanks, Chili.
Would you listen to him reading out the phone book?
I think I would.
Should we thank our team? Should we thank our team behind the glass?
I'll thank Alice Block, who's been the producer.
I'll thank Claire Urban, who's our studio manager. And we'll be back at the same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.